We have now entered the season of Great Lent. So this evening, I wanted to say something related to this season. Those of us who were together the day before yesterday also spoke about it then. In fact, we spoke about the first part of the whole period. As we said, that first part ended the day before yesterday on Cheese Fair Sunday. The second part began the next day, on Monday, the day known as Clean Monday. God willing, it too will end on Lazarus Saturday, giving way to Great Week. Great Week is the third part, in which all the events and teachings of this great season are brought together. This evening I wanted to take up a subject that is discussed by almost everyone who is religious. I would even venture to say that it is discussed by those who are not religious. Religious people attempt to put it into practice, while the irreligious ridicule it. Yet we are not in a position to give a proper answer to those before whom we are obliged to offer an enlightening defense of our faith, nor are we ourselves consistent with what we claim to believe. Thank you. The subject is fasting. It seems that among religious people there are as many opinions about this common subject called fasting, especially the fast of Great Lent, as there are people. Some began with a strict 3-day fast, starting on Sunday evening after Cheese Fair, not Meat Fair, because it was not Meat Fair Sunday. Meat Fair had already taken place the previous Sunday. They remained without food until Wednesday, when they went to receive Holy Communion without water, without food, without anything at all. A considerable proportion, perhaps 20 to 25% of religious people, did this properly. Others also observed the 3 days, but ate something, perhaps a piece of fruit, a rusk, some thin soup, or a little halva. They ate something. There are also those who ate food prepared with oil throughout all these days. And there are others who ate non-fasting food, even meat. They observed neither Meat Fair nor Cheese Fair. Everyone has an opinion. One person insists that what we eat does not matter at all. Others say that fasting simply means not eating non-fasting foods, while one may eat from the other foods that are available. Another says, "I am ill," while someone else says, "Children must eat because they are studying." Another one says, "But I have to work." Another says, "I'm an old man," and so on. There are so many opinions. Others say, "I'm on duty somewhere, and that's what they serve me." Others say, "It's a celebration. People have a wedding. They have a baptism. I'm eating at someone else's table," they say. "What am I supposed to do?" And there are 1,001 other thoughts and situations that come up around this subject. So, as far as time allows, what I would like to pass on to you is not my own opinions, but what I have read, what the Church says, what the Fathers say, and even what the scientists themselves say about the matter of fasting. It makes no difference that they do not call it fasting, but a diet. They call it a diet. They forbid you to eat certain things and perhaps allow you a little yogurt. When they prescribe it as a diet, you accept it. But when it is called fasting, you object. Yet many people would have no need of dieting if they fasted. If there were fasting in their lives, they wouldn't need to go on a diet, because fasting would preserve their health in such a way that they would have no need of the doctor. And of course, just how serious a matter this is, the facts themselves prove. Anyone who lived through what happened in 40 and 41 saw what fasting really means. That fasting was forced on us, of course, but the hardened arteries went away, the stomach troubles went away, the ulcers went away, the heart conditions went away, everything went away. And when that threat was lifted and the refrigerators started running again, and the steak grills and all the other devilish contraptions, the hospitals filled up, the mental hospitals filled up, everything filled up, Christ says, "Whoever wishes..." He forces no one. He wants no one beside him by compulsion. Whoever wishes, all he does is wake them up. God does not tolerate human cleverness. He does not debate these things. He does not tolerate them. That is why he sends the person behind him. "If anyone desires to come after me, not ahead of me, to tell me where we are going, nor beside me, so that we may debate it." A person has his own opinion, but if he wishes to follow, he must come behind me. "If anyone desires to come after me, if you do not wish to, then go your own way." "But I am rich." Very well, do whatever you think best. One day, however, you will come and face these things. we shall meet, whether you wish it or not. For now blaspheme me, for now reject me. For now make every contemptuous gesture against me with your hands and feet. Do whatever you wish. But one day we shall meet, and then we shall speak about it. That is the heart of the matter. God is good, but he is also just. Those who say only that God is love make a grave mistake. They want mercy for this world and justice only for the world to come. Does God have two unequal legs? Is God lame as our weakness and unbelief would like him to be? He is good toward us in this world, and we are called to make good use of God's forbearance and kindness, which lead us to metanoia, to repentance, and help us repent. For one day we shall stand face to face with the justice of God. It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God, when Christ himself, in his humanity, fell into the hands of God's justice, that justice raised him upon the cross. Fix what I am telling you firmly in your noose, your spiritual intellect. God did not compromise his justice, not even for his own son. His son was crucified so that his justice would not be compromised. Do we think that we shall escape it? It is absurd for us to think so. But because God does not cut off noses and ears today, because he does not seize us in the very act of sin, blasphemy, or wrongdoing and punish us on the spot, we draw false conclusions. If he did, we would need many sets of noses, many sets of ears, and many sets of eyes for God to cut off. Because he does not do this, we imagine either that he does not exist or that he has no power. But he both exists and has power. He is forbearing, he postpones punishment. He does not cancel it, he postpones it. The Greek word for forbearance literally means keeping wrath far away. God postpones punishment. Yet if a person refuses to come to terms with him here and accept the truth, that person will be punished. He will punish himself. But will God bind me and send me to hell? Read Proverbs 5:22. And you will see that God will not send you to hell. Your own sins will bind you and send you there. These things are written, and whoever does not study the scriptures goes astray. A person reads the newspapers and watches television, everything from advertisements to all that is shameful, degrading, and trivial, yet he does not read Holy Scripture. You are mistaken, not knowing the scriptures. Everything that will happen to us has been written there. Whoever reads and puts it into practice will escape condemnation. That is why I wanted to say a few words tonight about this subject. My beloved, fasting is not a human invention. As Basil the Great says, God gave the first commandment of fasting in paradise to the first two human beings. That is why, as I told you the other day, the church presents the subject of fasting through Adam and Eve on the Sunday of their expulsion. Why were they cast out? They were cast out because of their appetite. You shall not eat, God told them. He did not tell them not to drink, sit, walk, or pass by. He told them not to eat. They ate, and they were cast out. What did they gain by eating? Through eating they were expelled. That is why the church says, do you see Adam and Eve today, on Cheesefair Sunday, cast out of paradise? They were cast out because of their belly. And do you see the one who is crucified down there in the depths on Great and Holy Friday? It was because of the one who ate. So if you want to get back inside, then where he ate, you must not eat. Let us fast, therefore, that we may return to paradise. The first commandment of fasting was the one Adam received from God. Basil the Great says it in just these words. Fasting was ordained as law in paradise. That was the first commandment Adam received. But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. The words you shall not eat are a law of fasting and self-control. The words, you shall die. They ate, and humanity was cast out. Fasting, then, has existed from that time onward. If anyone wishes to examine things chronologically, he will find fasting in many places. Consider Elijah, who fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. Consider Moses, who fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, and received the law of God. Consider Christ himself, who fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. I will not dwell on these examples. I will ask you only one thing. Do you believe the account of Nineveh? I trust that you do. Historically speaking, those who read it believe it. Do you believe that a decree had gone forth for Nineveh to be destroyed?
3 days more, and Nineveh shall be destroyed.
That was Jonah's preaching. Was Nineveh destroyed? It was not. How did the people respond? Through fasting. When it became known that a prophet was preaching against Nineveh, and the news reached the king, the first thing he did was issue a decree. Everyone, officials and ordinary people, women, men, infants, and even the animals, was neither to eat nor drink. How did they know that fasting possessed such power? That was the command, that was the decree, and that is what saved Nineveh.
How did they know that fasting has such qualities, such power, and Nineveh was not destroyed?
From this example alone, one can understand. I will not discuss the other cases. If someone searches Holy Scripture for passages about fasting, he will find at least 120 passages in the Old Testament that speak of it.
And this man, in order to excuse his own weaknesses, says, "The priests made this whole thing up. The monks made it up, people who did not know what they were doing." My beloved, no one has ever made laws against his own belly. We all indulge our appetites and take care of them. Let us neither deceive ourselves nor lie to ourselves. The reason must be sought elsewhere. It is a great thing for a person to learn to fast, but it is difficult to learn if one was not taught from childhood. And unfortunately, our parents did not fast. Most of our spiritual fathers did not fast, and they still do not, and this causes great harm. A person loses much, both physically and spiritually. Self-restraint is a great thing. I am not telling you to undertake a fast, because when we speak of fasting, we mean going without food, not merely changing what we eat. We say that we do not eat fish or meat, and then we eat platefuls of bean soup with fine oil, half an okah of food and a fresh loaf of bread, and so on. That is not fasting, it is plundering. It is plundering, not fasting. Fasting, strictly speaking, means not eating. But who can do that today, because of the way of life we ourselves have created? Who can manage it? Within a few days, the sanatoriums and all the neurological clinics would be full. For we ourselves have made life this way. We are the ones who made it so. Angels did not come down from heaven and do it. But at the very least, we could practice self-control. We could abstain from certain things. Yet man is unwilling to make even the slightest sacrifice when it comes to his stomach and his tongue. And from that point onward he goes astray, spiritually, physically, and in his health. For he will lose not only eternity, he will lose this temporal life as well. He will reach the conditions we were reading about, and sooner than expected. If you wish, visit the hospitals, and you will see. And if you ask about each person's medical history, you will see that with his own two hands and his own teeth, he brought about his illness. You might find one case in 1,000 that comes from a temptation, 1 in 1,000. The rest we bring upon ourselves with our own hands, with our forks and knives, our frying pans and cooking pots. We prepare what we prepare, and then we suffer for it. Everyone has dealt with this subject, our wise men, our saints, Christ, and all the rest. They have all addressed at least the matter of self-control, the need to abstain from certain things. By the grace of God, I had the patient endurance to collect a few teachings. Listen to something the divine Chrysostom says, a man who had no ulterior motive at all, no interest in getting hold of our wallets or anything else, and he wasn't laying this down only for other people. The divine Chrysostom himself ate simply. The first thing he did when he went to Constantinople as patriarch was to dismiss the kitchen staff and sell off the cooking utensils. These were among his first orders when he entered the patriarchate. He dismissed the entire staff, the cooks and all the rest, and sold the kitchen utensils. They asked him, "Are we not going to eat?" He answered, "We did not come here to eat." And you should know that even his room had no bed. He would sit upon a chair. So this is not just any man speaking. This is a man who first lived these things in his own life and then offered them as instruction to others. Listen, then, to his teaching in simple words. By self-restraint, we do not mean complete abstinence from food.
We are not saying that you should eat nothing, for that would be to take your own life by force, since you would die if you ate nothing. Rather, we mean self-restraint aimed at overcoming the passions, so that we may cast off some of the passions that burden us. This is the life I wish to proclaim, he says. Self-control is the removal of sin, a way by which our sins may be diminished. It is estrangement from the passions, so that the passions may be brought into order. It is the mortification of the body, not death and the grave, but the subduing of the body so that it no longer wages war against the soul. I do not know whether you have considered this deeply, but the body and the soul are like a cat and a dog. Whatever benefits the soul, the body does not want, and whatever the body wants, the soul does not want. It is the mortification of the body, even of its natural impulses and desires. In other words, you must wage such a war and undertake such a struggle of self-control that you restrain even your natural desires. Someone may ask, what are these natural things? May I not eat at least a little bread? Eat a little less even of that. May I not drink water? Take a little less even of that and ask for guidance. That is how someone might put it today, for we have gone beyond what is natural. Now we also have things that are supernatural. If you go to someone who is in dire financial straits, and he happens to smoke, he will tell you, you know what a state I'm in, I haven't had a cigarette for a week. He does not say, I have no bread, but I have no cigarettes. Or someone will say, I went to see him, and he did not even have any cigarettes. In other words, we have elevated cigarettes above bread. Nowadays, it is not news that someone has no bread. What people tell you is, he does not even have money for cigarettes. For that man, smoking has now become something natural. Who has fasted from such things during these days? Even among those who have kept the food fast, who has fasted from cigarettes, who has fasted from coffee. These are passions, they are drugs, drugs. The only difference is that we take the nicotine little by little. Take a packet of cigarettes and give a dog, all at once, the amount of nicotine contained in it, the dog will die. But look at us. We take the drug one small dose at a time. We have created these things for ourselves, and John Chrysostom tells us that we should practice self-control even in things that are natural to us. You may be able to sleep for 8 hours. Do not sleep 8 hours now. Sleep 7 or sleep 6. And spend the other 2 hours praying, reading, or doing something else worthwhile. In other words, even in these natural needs, he leaves you free to exercise self-control. It is for your own benefit. It is a beautiful thing to do. He speaks of restraint even from natural impulses and desires. Self-control is the beginning of the spiritual life. Self-control is the means by which eternal blessings are obtained. Through it, the sting of pleasure is destroyed. Through self-control, that sting. Do you know what sting means? It is what the wasp has and thrusts into us. That is what you draw out when you practice self-control. When you are watchful, it no longer operates. It begins to die. You don't have that temptation of the flesh that you have when you feed yourself on the richest food. That's what is being taught here. And St. John of the Ladder says this, he who indulges his own belly, the man who pampers his stomach and denies it nothing and wants to conquer the spirit of fornication, when he says spirit of fornication, pay attention, because he means temptations of the flesh. He who indulges his stomach and yet wishes to overcome the spirit of fornication, that is, he keeps eating, while at the same time wanting not to be troubled by carnal temptations, is like someone trying to put out a fire with oil. It is as though there were a fire, and he went to extinguish it with oil. That is what a person does when he wishes to restrain, destroy, or uproot his carnal inclinations, yet does not fast. You eat without restraint, and whether you like it or not, your body becomes a blazing furnace. If you want to put it out so that you burn neither yourself nor those around you, you must deprive it of fuel. So when you pour oil on it, this furnace will burn both you and those around you. Thus it says, when the belly is afflicted, the heart is humbled. When the belly within is afflicted, because you have subjected it to restraint and so forth, the heart is humbled. it grows still, it is healed. When the belly is pampered, when you satisfy it with food and everything else, the logismos, the intrusive thought, grows insolent, it rebels, becomes angry, and breaks out into action. So, consequently, man is not greatly at fault, as these saints tell us, men who live this life and are sharing with us something of their own life and experience. Listen to another saying of this same Saint John Climacus, whose memory our church celebrates on the fourth Sunday of the fast. He speaks about self-control and its fruits, and how beneficial they are for man. Self-control is the mother of health, the sister of purity of the nous, the spiritual intellect, and of the soul. Self-control drives away sin and is the key to paradise. Adam and Eve ate, were cast out, and the key was taken from them. Now we refrain from eating, so that we may find the key and enter again. Gluttony is the head of sin. It directs the passions toward pleasures. It is the hand by which evil enters. It turns all the powers of man toward evil deeds, and at the same time toward hell. This is what killed Adam and drove him into exile, this lack of self-restraint, this failure of temperance. This is what closed paradise. This is what cost Esau his birthright, the rights of the firstborn, for the sake of his belly. For a single plate of lentils, he lost his birthright. This is what put the Hebrews to death in the wilderness over 40 years. Out of 3 million people, 2 of them entered in, all the rest left their bones in the wilderness. This same lack of self-control burned down the Pentapolis, Sodom, and Gomorrah because of arsenokitia, the sin of men lying with men. For if they had not been eating and feeding themselves the way they did, they would never have been turned aside into that deadly sin of arsenokitia. And it was this same thing that pushed Lot into incest. You know the story. He lay with his own daughters. And this same passion destroyed Eli along with his sons. He has still more thoughts besides these, which I didn't have time to copy out and pass on to you, but that's the gist of it. So this holy man, in one of his sayings, sets down the benefit both for the body and for the soul. Our own ancient Greek sages had not really grasped the question of the soul as deeply as they should have. The question of salvation, they had grasped the question of the mind. Hippocrates, for example. Hippocrates, the teacher of physicians, expresses this view. A well-fed belly does not produce a refined nous. In other words, he says, a full stomach does not make for a keen, illumined spiritual intellect. And sometimes we hear people speak of the barefoot children who grew up eating cornbread. They were the ones who studied, and they were the ones who rose in life. Our own pampered youngsters went on to higher studies, but they were as dense as bricks, in the fullest sense of the word. And this is true. Their teacher himself says so here, as I am reading to you. St. John Chrysostom also says, to eat too much without restraint, never practicing self-control or fasting, is proper to animals and wild beasts. That is for animals, he says, and for wild beasts, not for man. Otherwise, this way of living belongs to leopards, lions, bears, and other wild beasts, not to human beings. Human beings must exercise discernment. As I told you the other day, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are beneficial. God made everything for man, but man fell. Consequently, although all things may have been lawful then, now not all things are beneficial. You may be free to eat meat day and night, but the consequences show that it is not beneficial even as regards your health. You will collapse from heart disease or perish from something else. If you do not exercise the discernment that God has ordained for both the soul and the body of man. Our own Diogenes, whose lantern is still searching for a true human being, not merely someone human in outward appearance, but inwardly as well, has the following saying. Diogenes says that in houses where there is an abundance of food, there are many mice and cats. You find many mice and cats there, he says. Wherever there are mice, there will also be cats to eat them. Wherever homes are full of food. And he continues, and bodies that take in a great deal of food likewise bring diseases upon themselves. As he says, houses that have food stored inside also have mice and cats. In the same way, bodies that are well fed have illnesses and diseases. And this is true, as we said earlier, if fasting were imposed upon us, if God took our food away, we would all become well. All the hospitals would close, and so on. Out of every 100 sick people, only 10 would remain ill. The other 90 would be restored to health through fasting. But God does not desire this kind of compulsory fasting. Now someone will say, I cannot fast. No one is demanding it of you. If you truly cannot, and this has been established, just be careful about one thing. Do not trust yourself and do not trust your flesh. The human body is an ant lion, as the fathers call it. It whimpers and makes itself as weak as an ant, claiming it cannot go on, yet at other times you see it become a beast. How is it that you, who say you cannot even move your legs, suddenly become a beast? You know how that happens. He calls it an ant lion and tells us not to trust it. It is always whimpering. Watch it carefully. Sometimes you feel ready to collapse. Put just a little something in your mouth, whatever it may be, and you will see yourself revive at once. A moment before you were saying, I cannot go on, I am going to die now, I cannot take any more. Then suddenly it passes. These are Satan's tricks. He brings you to the point where you say, I'm fading, hold me up, I'm going, and yet you're not fading, you're not. There are cases, it's true, where a person's health really is shaken. A person has a drop in blood sugar, for example. Put a little candy in their mouth, and right away they're up and running again. So make sure you get to know that rascal, yourself, first, what it does to you. Because if there's one thing we don't know, it's our own self, if we know it at all. The ancients used to say, know thyself, and that means knowing both what is inside us and what is outside. We have never once taken the trouble to look at ourselves. We go to the doctor so they can give us a checkup and tell us what is going on. We ourselves know nothing about it. We have never tested ourselves to learn what the body can and cannot endure, what we can withhold from it and what we cannot, nor have we ever considered that we are dealing with an enemy of our soul. So when it has genuinely been established that a person cannot fast, he should do something else, something John Chrysostom teaches with great beauty and spiritual wisdom. Listen to what he says. If because of bodily weakness you are unable to remain without food for the day, notice, he is speaking about going without food altogether. Fasting does not mean changing what you eat. It means abstaining from food entirely. If he says you cannot do it because of your body, your constitution, your strength, your work, and so on, you can't do it because of bodily weakness. Not illness, mind you, but bodily weakness. You are not able to go without food for the whole day. No one in their right mind will be able to hold that against you. No one who has their wits about them, he says, can blame you so long as you genuinely can't do it. For we have a master who is gentle, he knows. You see, that master above us knows, and who loves mankind, and who asks nothing of us beyond our strength. He isn't asking for more than you have the strength to give, he says. But when your corns are hurting you and you say, I'm ill, I have to eat a steak, just because your corns are swollen, that is not right. Yes, we even hear excuses like that. I am sick. What sickness do you have? My corns are swollen. So he is going to eat a steak because his corns are swollen. I have counted blessed 10,000 times over, he says, the man who eats rather than the man who fasts and yet commits injustice. So let each one take care, both the one and the other. I would rather, he says, that a man eat something so long as he fasts at least with all his other senses. Let him commit no injustice, tell no lies, use no obscene language, indulge in no frivolous joking, and cackle at nothing improper. Let him not sit for 3, 4, or 5 hours in front of that demon box, swallowing everything lustful and corrupt that it shows him. If he does that, he is not fasting at all. I would rather, the saint says, that this person eat something but fast from those things. I say this because some are immediately ready to jump up and declare, I do not fast from food, but I am careful about everything else. So is the saint saying here that we don't need to fast. He heads that off in advance, as though he knew how crafty we would be today. And he says, Tota lego, O Nestian lion, all you Sabaean keratin, I say these things not to do away with fasting, but to preach piety, true reverence toward God. It's not that you shouldn't fast, and I am not abolishing the fast. Rather, I am preaching piety. I am preaching piety. I am not preaching that we should set the fast aside. I do not know whether these few words have been enough. I have also written a special book entitled Fasting, A Commandment of God. Everything is set out there, the canons and all these matters, but I will not dwell on that now. With these few words, this is what I ventured to do, to show you that fasting is a benefit not only for the soul. Let's set that aside for now. At least it's a benefit for the body, and at the same time the soul is served too. Try it. If you go to the presanctified liturgy, you hear a psalm, Psalm 33, which has this line in it, "Taste and see that the Lord is good." Try it, it says, and you will see that the Lord is good. The word is not Christ, but Christos, meaning good. The Lord is good. Try it. Taste and see. Do not remain at a distance. I may tell you that Parnassus or Olympus rises 2,000 meters high. Likewise, I may tell you the heights to which fasting can lead. But you must set out yourselves. Can you not reach the very summit? Go halfway. Go 100, 200, or 500 meters. Do not stand far away saying, "Ah, that cannot be done." Do whatever you are able to do. Can you not give up meat? Then give up meat and stop at fish. The Annunciation. When I was at home, I ate fasting food. When I went out to a feast or some other occasion, I did not. It took me 8, 9, even 10 years before I was able to stand firm and fast as the Church teaches. Let us not deceive ourselves. Fasting can be achieved. And here I would like to say something, because we have many people who are ill. You know, the doctor told me, the doctor did well to advise you, but do not listen to him in this particular matter. I have many brethren who have diabetes, who are diabetics. Meat and fish. Those gentlemen are mistaken. None of that. Let the pancreas rest. Eat fruit. Nothing will happen to you. Eat fruit, eat salads, and let the pancreas rest. Is there any better medicine than giving it rest? It keeps working and working. You never let it rest. It can be done. It is achievable. It is possible. You have never tried it, yet putting it into practice is difficult. What you say is all very well, Panagopoulos, but what does this "but" mean? I want to fast, but my husband will not let me. Or I want to fast, but my wife will not let me. You will serve me meat, and you may eat whatever you like. Or perhaps I am at work, and they serve us meat on Wednesday and Friday of all days, while on the other days they serve food cooked with oil. Bean soup. What can you do? That depends on you. Suppose you were in love and they would not let you attain what you desired. What would you do? You would use every kind of cunning to achieve it, every kind of cunning. I know people in the police who are served meat, they do not eat it, they would rather eat elsewhere, or they take it saying, "I'll have it at home," then throw it away and eat bread. There are solutions. All it takes is for a person to want it, so you'll pay for it out of your own pocket, fine, just don't lose your soul. After all, evil these days is organized. And how are you supposed to struggle when everything is against you? They're handing you poison. What of it? Because they're giving it to you free, you have to take it. You don't take it. Nobody told you to go out and start shouting about it. Quietly do your duty before God, and He who sees you in secret will reward you openly. We would see good results in the home, among children and between husbands and wives alike, if we knew one particular account, if we had read it and taken it to heart. It is found in the book of Daniel, in the Old Testament, in the first chapter. Do you know what happened there? Daniel was taken captive there with other Jews because of their unfaithfulness, and God permitted them to remain in bondage for 70 years. The king of that land then gave an order to his servants. They were to select handsome young men without any blemish, not lame or blind, but intelligent, good-looking, and strong. These young men were to be set apart. They would not be fed like the other captives in the camp. They would be fed from the royal delicacies, whatever was served at the king's own table. These young men were to eat as well, and among these young men there were four boys in particular, Daniel and three others, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The king wanted to make these youths wise through this food, and then use them like janissaries against the other Jews. Later he intended to appoint them as leaders over their fellow Jews. When this command and decree were announced, Daniel and the others found themselves in a difficult position. They begged the official in charge, if possible, to allow them not to eat that food. But that man did not believe in Daniel's God. He said to him, "This cannot be done, because when the king comes in a few days to inspect you and sees that you are weak, my head will no longer remain on my shoulders. He will say that I was stealing your food rations, and that this is why you are in such a state." "I cannot do this," Daniel replied. "Why not test us for 10 days? After 10 days, look at us and see whether we are any weaker, and whether your head is truly in danger." But these youths prayed, and they found grace. Daniel resolved in his heart not to defile himself with the king's food or with the wine the king drank. He therefore asked the chief eunuch to allow him not to defile himself, and the Lord granted Daniel honor and grace in the sight of the chief eunuch. "Do you truly want to fast, but others will not let you? Do what Daniel did, pray. Then you will hear your husband say, 'Do whatever you want, just prepare this for me,' and you will immediately be free to fast. Or your wife will tell you, 'Do whatever you want,' and so you will fast, even if your spouse does not. Unfortunately, we approach the matter as though all we need to do is write it down so that I, Panagopoulos, may learn about it. Or, at most, we might mention it to the priest, too. What will happen? But that is not your real concern, nor is it ours. Our concern is this: my God, this fast must be kept. Since I am able to do it, since you have given me the health, I must also honor your Wednesday, when we betrayed you, and your Friday, when you were crucified for us. And I must honor this whole great Lent, which you yourself fasted. You had no need to fast, yet you did so to leave us an example. Help me speak. Speak good things to my husband. Speak good things to my children. Speak good things to my wife. You must stand firm. Your hands and knees should become calloused like a goat's from kneeling, and your forehead should strike the floor. Ask God, and then you will see, like an engineer taking a screwdriver, God will turn the mind in the right direction. He will turn the mind of the wife, the son, the husband, this person or that, and you will be able to do what is beneficial for your soul." Daniel found grace, Scripture says grace, that did not come from himself. "My God, help me in this difficult moment so that I may not oppose your will." And he found grace and mercy in the sight of the chief eunuch, and the chief eunuch found a way as well. Do you know what he did? You see, Daniel did not suggest this to him. He came up with it himself. Or rather, where did he find it? The one above whispered it to him from the ceiling, from the roof. Do you know what he did? He would take the children's allotted portion of rich food and keep it for himself, while they, it seems, ate legumes and drank water. As far as the records were concerned, everything was in order. He had received the food. He did not say, "I do not want 10 portions, prepare 7 for me." How could he not take 10? How many people did he have? 10. So 10 portions had to be served. He accepted them. He thought of this solution himself. And the chief eunuch said to Daniel, "I fear my Lord," and so forth, as I told you earlier. And Daniel said to him, "Please test your servants for 10 days, and let us be given legumes to eat, and let us have water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the king's delicacies. Look at us who abstain from those foods and eat fasting fare, and look at those over there feasting on rich, buttery foods, and let us see what happens. Then deal with your servants according to what you see." And so he listened to him in this matter and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, the faces of these children, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, appeared fairer and their bodies healthier and better nourished than those of all the young men who ate from the king's delicacies. So Melzar, that was the name of the overseer, continued taking away their food and the wine they were supposed to drink, and he gave them legumes instead, And to these four young men God gave, after this sacrifice of theirs, God also acted knowledge and understanding in every kind of learning and wisdom. To these children God gave all knowledge, all understanding, and wisdom. And this came after that struggle of theirs, after they had fasted. And where were they? Do you realize, in their own home, in Babylonia, as captives? Imagine being in Dachau today and saying, "It's Christmas now, I'm a Christian, I'm going to fast," or "It's Great Lent." Come now, eat whatever you can find, and when you return to your homeland, then you can fast. Will we ever find such food again? That is how someone else would answer. But Daniel did not. My God, help me not to be defiled, not to be made unclean. Why do you think that because the food is roasted, browned, and well prepared, it is something good? It is filth and foulness. You may think you are simply eating, but you are defiled by what is unclean, because it has not been blessed. Anything that is not blessed, even if you eat it with a blessing, allows Satan himself to enter the person. Once there was a man possessed by a demon, and they took him to an elder. The man who had become possessed was a monk. The elder cast out the demon. The demon departed, crying out to him. He called out to it, "Come here," he said. It came out of the man like a black dog. "Tell me," he said, "why did you enter the image of God?" "I did not enter him," it said. "I was in the garden, sitting on a cabbage, and this man," it said, "even though the bell had rung for vespers, did not go to vespers. Without receiving a blessing, he came, cut the cabbage and ate it, and that is how I found myself inside him. Do you understand? There was no blessing, only the dominion of Satan." This happened at the monastery of the Most Holy Theotokos Kaliviani, in Crete. And where is the priest? There is Papoutsakis, who has now become Archbishop of Crete. They often take many demon-possessed people to him, and among the many who are brought, some are left there to recover, and so forth. There was one man who never came to the table, he would not eat. You understand, Satan seeks to waste a person away, to make him consumptive and remove him from this life. They could not get him to eat anything. When then did he eat? Whenever he ate before the bells rang for the meal in the refectory, he would secretly go to the cook, and the cook would put some food on his plate in his mess tin for him to eat, and he would sit down and devour it greedily because he was hungry. But if someone caught him in time and said, "Do not eat yet, wait for me to make the sign of the cross over the food," then the moment he crossed the food, the man would leave it and go away. He would not eat it. He ate only food without the sign of the cross, without prayer. He would eat it unblessed, without prayer. But he would not eat food that had been blessed. Do you understand? So there is no excuse for us. The church provides a fast for adults and for children, for a woman who has just given birth, for the sick, and for everyone. Fasting kills the passions. It does not kill the body. If people kept a proper three-day fast, a true three-day fast, with complete abstinence from food, all the illicit rooms would close, every house of prostitution would close, and every means of corruption would fall silent. Everything would shut down. The illicit beds would be torn down. We would stop. Fasting is the very thing that destroys all of this. Keep a fast for 3 days, and then go and try to talk about sex. The passions are quenched. The passions have stopped. This worm is the one being fed. And it has left nothing standing. The child is studying. Yes, the child studies. But where were they on Saturday night? And after the studying, where do they go and what do they do? Look elsewhere for the strength you need for the child who is studying, not to food. The child used stuff with food so that it can study understands nothing. Have the child fast in other things, hold back somewhere else, and build up the child's strength that way. The same for the young woman, and for you and for me, from somewhere else. It doesn't come from there. Simple food, fruit, for example, a cup of tea, lovely. Whole grain things, a couple of good olives, none of the nonsense, and so on. A bit of lettuce, a cucumber, all these things. That gives you a clean stomach, a light stomach. The eye sees differently. The stomach has its own way of digesting, and the mind thinks differently as well. We simply have not tried it. What we spoke of a moment ago has to happen. O taste and see that the Lord is good. We have no excuse for this, my beloved, and all the more so in our own day and in the society we live in, where there are so many things available to us. The things a person can restrain are the desires of the flesh. And so in these days, many people are discussing this. Some make a show of their fasting, others make a show of not fasting. Neither means anything. I am inclined to trust neither the one who displays his fasting, nor the one who says it does not matter. If you cannot fast, God accepts that. Take care to find a discerning spiritual father who, if possible, himself fasts, and then follow his guidance. Whatever he tells you will then be blessed. Otherwise, there will always be a struggle within you, and you will look for arguments to justify your transgression. That inner voice will object, and will always cry out within you, that what you have done is not right, and you will search for lies to tell it. Sit down and be quiet. I repeat, a person encounters many difficulties in putting this great virtue into practice. There is also that case I mentioned a moment ago. What am I to do? Someone wrote me a note here. We're going to a feast. What should we do? You know that at the feast you're going to, there won't be any fasting food. So you won't go. You'll fall ill. And do not go. That's if you want to do it the right way. And if you do want to go, then come to an understanding with the one whose name day it is. Tell them, we'll come, but you know it's Great Lent. We'll come to you, Mr. Theodore and Mrs. Theodora, tomorrow. We'll come to you, Mr. Vangelis, the day after tomorrow, and we'll have fish, salt cod, something along those lines. I'm not going to eat meat. If you'd like us to come, we won't put your table to any trouble. Otherwise, you have God's blessing and ours. But we won't be coming. Saturday, the day after tomorrow, oil is allowed. So cook us a little squid. Make us a few potatoes. Make us something else. Will the world come to an end if we do not eat for one day? We are Christians. How can we offer you our good wishes otherwise? How? What did those saints Theodore eat, the saints who directed the people to eat wheat? Simply boiled wheat. How can such a thing be right? And I will eat lamb the day after tomorrow because my name is Theodore, and Saint Theodore can burst for all I care. How can we behave like this? It is a sin. I cannot approve of it. I go to someone's home and he brings me a non-fasting sweet. Please forgive me, but no, I am fasting, it is a fast, and I will not take it. Give me a little water so that I may offer you my good wishes. By next year, may you have changed your way of thinking. Yes, by next year, may you have changed your way of thinking. Because if you, the relative, the Christian, who with God's help has learned something, do not pass this on, but give way in everything as though nothing were wrong, what will happen? Tomorrow that person will say, oh, a Christian woman used to come here. She never made any demands on us. She ate whatever we gave her, and so on. How, then, are we supposed to understand? What will happen? These are matters to which a person must pay attention. And here I want us to take special care concerning our children. Our children. We must teach them from now to fast. Not send them to a sanatorium, but teach them to fast. If the doctor prescribes a diet and rice water, we will give it to them, but now that Christ says it, we will not. If you do not want to fall into the doctor's hands, do what Christ says and be assured of it, whatever may happen. Therefore, with the guidance of a discerning spiritual father, one who himself fasts, if possible, set out on the right path in these matters. Struggle as much as you can without breaking up your homes, without destroying marriages, and without causing such things to fall apart. Work within the bounds of what is possible, bringing illumination, and with the grace of God and prayer, may we too be able to struggle and pass on something beneficial to every person, especially in today's corrupt society. Amen.